the meeting of the Customer Service and Operations Committee is open, and too much stuff. First item is agenda and minutes. The chair would entertain a motion to approve.
So,
moved and seconded. Any comment? All those in favor of the approval of the agenda and minutes signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. As opposed. First item is the Accessibility Advisory Committee.
Good morning. My name is Christian Kent. For those of you I have not met, I am the Assistant General Manager for the Department of Access Services, and I have an action item to present this morning for your consideration regarding a change to the governance of the Accessibility Advisory Committee, and I'd like to provide some background. This committee was established in 1979. It serves as the primary means of advising Metro management on issues of accessibility. It was created in response to a Department of Transportation regulation that requires public involvement in the planning process of federally supported programs. Our advisory committee has made many important contributions to the accessibility of the Metro system, as well as features that, frankly, are benefits to everyone who uses Metro, because they're not only accessibility benefits, but also safety. At this time, there is a difference between the functionality of this committee and the Riders Advisory Council in that it currently reports to our general manager and CEO. If I could go back, please. The chairman of the Accessibility Advisory Committee sits on the Riders Advisory Council, so there is some cross-communication between these two representative groups. So this action and the purpose behind it is to change the governance so that both committees provide information and advice to the Board of Directors. This slide gives a comparison of the current operation of the committee and that which is proposed. And again, you can see the change in the reporting relationship, that the functionality of the committee is defined through bylaws that are part of the resolution in your packet. We in the Department of Access Services provide staff support to this committee, and with the board reporting relationship, that would be augmented by staff from the board secretary's office. Appointment of members would shift to the board, and there's also a provision in this resolution to allow representation from the Council of Governments Access for All Committee, which is a group that allows for input into the regional planning process by people with low income and people with disabilities throughout the region.
Mr. Benjamin?
I just noticed on here that you are increasing the responsibility of the board secretary's office. Do they have the staff to do this?
The only thing that we ask of the board secretary's office is to make sure that the manner in which information is transmitted to the board is consistent with all other material that comes through. We're not adding any work for them.
Okay,
it's just
so this is
pretty
the
much
responsibility
advice.
They already have.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
And so the recommendation is to approve this resolution. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions or comments?
Mr. Chairman, I want to thank Mr. Kent for bringing us forward, and most importantly, the AFA or AAC for the work that they've done. I had a meeting, and I think we received some communication from the committee. And as I look through and hear, as we go through the resolution as well as the bylaws, on page 5, there's an inconsistency, and I would like to know whether the board members would like to address the concern that they have regarding the position of the chair and the election. And it says it will, on number 5A, the chair, it says it will annually elect a chair. And then it says it has a term of 2 years. And I think the consistency they wanted was a 2-year chair. And I think we can correct our problem here unless there are some objections of simply editing that to remove annually, unless there are some concerns by this board on that. And I think the other part that's been raised, and it's not as easy, but it may, my view is that if it helps improve the function of the role that they play, I don't have a concern, and maybe the board should not either. On page 6, it talks about elections, and it says the first regular meeting. And if I understand, they meet very early in the year, and it's also the appointing time. And the question raised of would it be better to have the elections the next month so that there is a established board in place, a committee in place in order to do that. I kind of note that we kind of do the same thing. The function is just shifted a little bit differently. But those were the concerns that were raised. And I think we can leave it as it is, or we can work and see whether there is some way that they are not constrained by these bylaws as to how they can best function.
I think there's unanimous agreement about Ms. Hudgens' first point. And does staff have any recommendation about dealing with the second?
Well, just for clarification, the way that it's written is that the members would serve out the terms that they have. I do know that there are some vacancies that need to be filled, but was that the intent, is to have us immediately proceed to fill those vacancies? That was the intent, so yes.
So your yes is, let's make clear what you're saying yes to, immediately filling the vacancies. And if they cannot fill the vacancies, because what I did hear is that in seeking new people, it's very difficult to find those folks to make sure that they can make fill the vacancies at a time where they can begin functioning. Mm-hmm. Do you have an election without adequate number of people?
The manner in which we've been proceeding is that when there has not been an ability or a failure to elect, then members who are currently on the committee have the opportunity to continue serving until there is opportunity to install a new member. Some of the members on the committee now are serving in that capacity, but there's definitely going to be a need to do an immediate recruitment to fill the vacancies.
Well, with that, the consistency is it's the same cycle that we are all on. And I think that helps. And so to the extent that we can all do our due diligence in making sure that we fill the committees rapidly, it would help.
Mr. Benjamin's next. Then.
I have a similar set of comments, actually. On the resolution that we are to pass, on page 2, the second resolved down, it says that we hereby appoint the 20 AAC members. Which 20?
So that is also something we need to amend so that it does not give the impression that it's the approval of 20 new people, but just the approval of the committee in that structure that it will have 20 members.
Okay, so we're not saying that we're appointing 20 members.
Right.
We are at this point saying that the committee will consist of 20 members?
Yes.
Because this says we are hereby appointing.
Yes, now that needs to be corrected.
All right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, or that the board
creates?
Or that the committee will have 20 members, all of which are detailed above.
Yes.
It's actually an unnecessary piece if we're not actually doing anything.
We can fix that.
Okay. And just a very minor one.
Strike that.
I would tend to strike it since everything above totals 20, doesn't it?
Pardon?
That you've noted in the previous resolves who all the members are going to be. where they're going to come from, which I didn't try adding up, but I presume adds to 20.
Yes.
Therefore, this really doesn't do anything.
Yes.
It's so we might. Term of 3 years. That's not elsewhere. Mm-hmm.
That's correct, and that's consistent with the Riders
okay.
Advisory
do,
Council.
Do you want to change this for us before we actually vote on it?
Yes.
Between now and
between,
the board meeting?
Yes, sir. We'll take care
so
of that.
So it actually says what it is we're doing?
Yes, sir.
And just a very minor thing, on page 2 of the attachment of bylaws, responsibilities, item 10, I assume the word that you wanted in there was interact with the Riders Advisory Committee. Which isn't what mine says. or council, I guess?
Yes.
A council, not a committee.
Yes, yes.
Riders
yes,
Advisory Council.
Yes.
Okay. That's minor. But the other one, if you can clarify that, I think we can vote on it now to send it to the board, but we need to have a clarification of that resolve.
Technical amendment.
Mr. Chairman?
Aye.
I want to go back to the one that Mr. Benjamin was talking about in the resolve. And again, this is in the nature of technical. Are we restarting everybody's terms by changing the way that this group relates to us? So you have some people who are serving, might be in the middle of serving, or is everybody going to have everybody who's there now is a 3-year term?
I think that the intent was to allow them to serve out their existing terms
uh-huh.
because they're already staggered.
Right.
So it would just be to you would be appointing vacant people into vacant positions.
So anybody new comes in, they get a 3-year
term. Could you clarify that in the language to make sure that there's no misunderstanding?
Yes, sir.
The other question that I have two other questions. One is. Currently, my understanding is the chairman of the existing committee has a named seat on the Riders Advisory Council.
Yes, ma'am.
Do you intend to preserve that?
Yes.
Okay. So they. Okay. So they're not they're not parallel bodies. Is there somebody from the Riders Advisory who sits?
The reason why this was done is because because of the broad scope of issues that the Riders Advisory Council reviews, that it's pretty much been their consensus from the beginning that they wanted to refer accessibility issues to the other committee. So having the chair sit on the Riders Advisory Council is the opportunity for that information to flow back and forth between them.
Okay. Then my last question is, on the Riders Advisory Council, they have a vice chair. They have two vice chairs. Mm-hmm. One, so they all three jurisdictions have a role in leadership. Mm-hmm. That is not suggested here, and I wonder what the reason was.
It was just something that was not suggested. It could be put in here.
Well, except now the way we're going to appoint them is jurisdictionally based, mm-hmm. and so it seems to me we ought to at least allow for that.
Mm-hmm.
We could say one or two vice chairs, and that gives them the freedom if they want to organize that way to do so rather than trying to.
I'll wait until they can tell us what they want to do.
Right. Well, I'd rather be permissive on this one, actually, Mr. Benjamin. But
we can do that.
Any other suggestions about changes, clarifications? Hearing none, that is it the consensus of the committee to recommend to the board?
Mr. Chairman, I would move that we move this forward to the board with the changes recommended.
Second. A motion made and seconded. Hearing no further debate, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Thank you.
Thank you.
Vital signs scorecard of operational performance.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Andrea Burnside, Chief Performance Officer. Today I'm here to summarize the most recent results in this vital signs report for December's key performance indicators for most measures and to highlight actions being taken to improve performance. Next slide. In December, Metro Bus Service reached its best on-time performance since the beginning of the fiscal year, continuing its prior two-month pattern of improvement. The realignment of service operation managers on the street continued to positively affect on-time performance because the SOMs can address service challenges promptly. December railcar door malfunctions continued to impact system-wide on-time performance and railcar reliability measured by the mean distance between delays. Many door troubles are directly tied to customer interaction, indicating that some improved communication is needed with our customers. Staff continue to step up efforts to reduce the impacts of delays caused by those door malfunctions. Escalator, which, as you know, will be the topic of the next presentation, escalator availability increased in December 2010, 1.9%, which basically equals 11 units, following the completion of November's brake inspections that shut down every escalator for a brief time. In terms of employee injuries, they continue to decline and have reached the lowest level since the beginning of the fiscal year, which represents a 15% reduction from the prior month of November. Bus transportation continues to represent the largest portion of injuries at 41%, but the department's overall injuries have declined due to an aggressive implementation of the at-risk program, and the superintendents have been equipped with really great new tools, such as the drive cam, to conduct better investigations. And finally, the commendation rate increased for bus and Metro Access, which reflects service changes and improvements that have been made. Metro Access's commendation rate continued to indicate improvements in on-time performance, which are closely tied to the complaint and commendation rates. There were also 328 fewer Metro complaints overall in December as compared to November. Next slide. Looking at the performance action highlights, the actions that we're taking to continue to improve performance. Bus, as we've reported before, is receiving 152 new buses between March and December of 2011 this year. As the new buses are put into service, older and less reliable buses will be retired. In anticipation of that improved performance, we will adjust the reliability target next month. I'll talk about that a little bit later. We continue to analyze the causes of delay and their impacts to on-time performance, and use information to identify campaigns on the railcar side where 10 to 20 railcars are taken out of service at a time to address a set of maintenance items that can be implemented by fleet and by season to improve the overall rail fleet reliability. And finally, as you know,
work a question on mm-hmm. campaigns. Is that in addition to when they're brought in for regular maintenance, or is it part of a scheduled shop time?
That would be in addition to
experiments. Okay.
Work will begin on the Foggy Bottom station in January to replace three old unreliable escalators with new escalators add a staircase to increase accessibility to the station, and as well as a canopy to protect those brand new escalators. Next slide. We've talked with this committee in the past about target and target setting, and wanted to get back with you to let you know that we have begun to reevaluate targets. And we've looked at best practices in accomplishing target setting, and looking at the National Cooperative Highway Research Program report, 666, an unfortunate number, but it's a good report. Looking at target setting methods and looking at what steps should be taken in terms of looking at the factors influencing target setting, internal and external factors, political factors, looking at how much control the agency has over the targets, financial factors, and so on. Looking at the appropriate approaches for target setting. So do you use kind of a unilateral executive edict? Or do you use a collaborative approach with senior staff? Do you look at analytically grounded kind of analysis coupled with satisfactory public input? And then finally, looking at adjusting your targets over time based upon funding levels and so on, availability of new equipment. So as I mentioned a few moments ago, bus maintenance is leading the way in this and have evaluated the performance of their fleet in detail and have developed a new target, which will be, which is indicated in the vital signs for next month, so starting effective January 1st. They've increased their target by 700 miles, going from the current 6,700 to 7,400 miles next month. And some of the things that they looked at, they did a really in-depth analysis and put together a really nice white paper on it, actually. Looking at this, a statistical sample, I should say, of 12 months of data for FY10 on reliability of the bus fleet. They came up with a range from kind of conservative to aggressive, semi-aggressive, and then they looked at what the right target within that range might be, taking into account factors such as the deployment of 50 new buses, but also considering that we have a new emissions technology that is somewhat untested, so it provides for all those considerations. And finally, next slide. In summary, as I've said in the past, we're beginning to use performance information to guide decision-making, linking actions to performance outcomes, and we are making progress. Next steps, we are continuing to develop and track execution plans with the department, so the department-level plan on how they're going to implement against the goals and objectives of the organization, turning data into useful performance information, evaluating actions to improve performance, and continuing with our external focus on other agencies, the federal government, and other national organizations to ensure that we're using best practices in performance management. And others have actually begun to talk to us about what we're doing. So hopefully sometime we'll be seen as a leader soon. And that concludes my presentation on vital signs.
Very good presentation. I'm very happy we're moving this direction. My question is to the CEO on how he plans to use these targets as part of managing the organization.
Well, we've already started with regard to using the targets that have been set up already. As I meet with the members of the executive leadership team and we review performance every month, one of the issues that we review is where we stand in terms of meeting those key performance targets. And if there's problematic ones or ones that don't seem to be heading in the right direction, then we actually have more in-depth reviews, and I expect to get to the bottom of it and why we're having those problems and what we can do to correct it. So it's a monthly review.
And oftentimes when one has those kinds of reviews, there's a little bit of this kind of discussion. I'm doing my part, but somebody else isn't doing theirs, but it stops with you, right?
That's right. That's when we all get in the room and figure that one out.
Ms. Porter?
I just wanted to clarify. You mentioned that the Metrobus on time targets would be adjusted with the new information. We had also talked, I remember, the last month about getting new information on how we actually compute on-time performance, and that I want to just make sure that's still part of the plan.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, I had a question, and thank you for this presentation. I think we've made a number of great strides in terms of measuring our performance in a number of areas, so kudos to you and the CEO of the organization. My question is really, how do we use these indicators as a board, and what sort of target should we establish in order to hold the organization accountable? Is it a subset of these indicators? In order to do that, you would have to buy it, or the board as a whole would have to buy it to the indicators so we can measure our progress in terms of meeting certain standards, for instance, escalators, which we'll cover in the next presentation. So this is just a general question to the board is how do we use these indicators to guide, you know, our understanding of the system in terms of how it's performing, and then also how do we use them to hold, you know, the rest of the agency accountable in terms of meeting these standards so we don't get into the micromanagement of it, but also to some extent, we set an expectation level that we feel is achievable within a certain time frame. So part of it is, you know, trying to understand the how you come up with the targets, and then understand bringing it back to the board so we either buy into it or we ask our questions, and perhaps even adopting them as yearly standards. So that's just a question I'm throwing out there for discussion.
It's an excellent question, and normally, the budget process would be the vehicle through which the board addresses and formalizes performance targets for the year. The budget is to produce a product. The board's role with the GM is to specify the performance targets for the year and provide the resources to the staff to deliver that product. We have not linked, traditionally, the budget and the performance agenda. I think the board needs to, and I would later in the process of developing the budget, recommend to the board that we carefully link specific performance targets to the budget adoption process. And I think that's part of the discussions we'll be having about board governance and focusing on the highest level of accountability for both the board and the staff about executing a budget. I think without that, we really don't have accountability for what we produce, and would look forward to working with Rich and his staff about the development of the performance targets for fiscal year 12 as part of the budget. I think it is as important as the financials, and the financials don't make sense without linking them to these specific performance targets. I was kidding Rich for a while. The authority was proud of its ability to track performance, so much so that there was a giant performance board right outside here. And then I noticed that for a while when the numbers got bad, the numbers didn't change anymore. They just kind of froze. Then the board went blank. Then the board disappeared. And Rich said,
the board will be back.
The other would be performance numbers that are real time and available on our website up front. It's difficult to find. A general criticism about the stodginess of our website in general about WMATA.com is the inaccessibility for customers to be able to track key data. And performance, if it's going to be outside the door here, needs to be on the front page of our website as well. And that's another way of being accountable to the public for officially established performance criteria that's part of the budget and something that we all agree that we'll be accountable for. So
we do have an online scorecard. I don't know if you've had an opportunity to look at that on the, okay.
It's just not, it's not upfront. It's not okay. Easily accessible, but.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question on rail fleet reliability, page 47 of 85, or number 11, whatever code you want to look at, page number. We seem to have continual problems with the doors. And, the way I'm reading this, it appears that a lot of the newer cars are having the door problem, not necessarily the older cars. Am I reading that correctly? And what is the problem with the doors? And are we seeing more problems on some of our newer cars that we need to kind of look at and find out what the problem is? So who wants to try at that one?
I'll follow up on that. The doors as a whole, we are analyzing each, again, particular fleet on what's creating, some of the issues in the performance areas. For example, like on the 1000 series, we do know that as these cars are getting older and stuff and the weight and stuff sometimes has an impact on the way that they actually operate correctly. Also settings and stuff of those. The newer doors, for example, in the 2, 3, and 6000 series rail car, we've brought in the vendor who manufactures for all of those across the board to try to establish a standardized maintenance process. It does not make sense on the way that the programs were set up to have the same door, but yet you have different fleets and they're trying to address different tasks or settings for those. That in turn impacts your maintenance staff because they're working on what they think is a NEPA door, and they think it should be, you know, universal, and there's different processes allocated to that. So that is the ongoing process. Also, the review of the performance on whenever we do have incidents that are related to doors where we know we have a potential failure, and being able to track and trend that. One of the things that we do know that is a big challenge on our part is, again, with the belling of the 1000 series car, we've got equipment that is train line communications and such that has to go through from, you know, from one end to the next, and it's constantly tweaking and adjusting those settings because we have electric doors, we have pneumatic doors, and there's all different configurations that we're having to try to blend to make work as seamlessly as possible.
So as we go to our 7000 series and look at the design of the doors, what are we learning from all this?
Well, first of all, we'll have a standalone fleet, so that way we'll be able to have much better diagnostics on this. The other thing that we've learned that we're going to be applying is that each door leaf has a operator. So basically, this operator operates independent of this one here. They have to work together, and then you have the additional safety features and switches. The new approach on the 7000 series is we'll have one door operator that controls both door leaves. We just cut our potential for failure in 50% by that design, which is a huge savings operationally, capital-wise, and over the life cycle of that. Also, we'll have much better diagnostics. For example, the rail car, when the operators are operating now, you see where they open the doors and they close them is because the operators are totally in the dark of which door potentially could have an issue. This new rail car will have a diagnostic screen on top that will let them know the status of every door. So if they go to close it, and then they know that they've got an issue on rail car, 7080, and it's in the back, they'll know down to the rail car in the consist as well as to the door number, and they'll be able to short cycle that, because we also have a lot of times when you open everything back up, people have a tendency to say, okay, they're opening the doors and let us, you know, make that rush again to get in there, you know, to load on there and board. So those are some, our transportation staff is very, very excited. They've asked us repeatedly, can we apply that now? Unfortunately, that's a lot of money to get that equipped. So we are taking these very, very valuable lessons learned and applying to move it forward. But again, we're definitely focused on what we have because we have to live with this, you know, for years to come. And we are also going further into looking at, as we were talking about campaigns earlier in some of the reports and stuff, it's one of the things to maybe start bringing these cars in above and beyond and start doing some massive effort to really kind of get everybody's attention on this. And it is, for example, with the upcoming holiday summer months, cherry blossom festivals, it's a big focus, doors and air conditioning.
Thank you for that brief answer.
Yes, sir.
Very thorough, though.
I want to go back for a moment to our last conversation about the performance measures, because I noticed that, you know, some of these areas have targets and some don't. And I think particularly for the newer board members, it would be helpful to remind us how the targets were set, when they were set, who set them, because if we're going to have a conversation about what they ought to be, we ought to understand a little bit better how we got to the ones that are in here and why in some categories there isn't a target set. And I bring that up because I'm in favor of targets, but I also offer some caution that this should not become an exercise of pass-fail. This should become an exercise of us having a conversation in an area where there's a drop. The board better understanding sooner why, and what, if anything, we can do to help with that. Because just looking at these numbers absent explanation might lead to wrong conclusions. And an example that I would give is on the Metro Access on-time performance. You see this significant drop in February. Well, we had 2 feet of snow in February. So there's there's an issue there that we can't address. But we need to have a conversation so that the customers know, if you're just looking at this scorecard, that there's a reason for that. And it might not have anything to do with management. It might not have anything to do with operators. But it might have to do with things beyond our control. And so when we look back at
you know, what has a target and what doesn't. We need to understand why, but moving forward, if we are going to set targets for some of these, we need to be realistic in what our expectation is and what our product is that we're hoping to get out of that. And the product ought to be how we can help the system improve that number, not a measurement of, well, this month we failed or this month we passed, because without explanation, the targets are no good. And so I just offer that as a caution, and I think we should get an explanation as to how these targets were arrived at, when, and what the rationale behind them is, and then in addition, where we don't have targets, the reasons why we don't.
If I could suggest, frankly, many of these targets are historic in nature and existed before the Office of Performance was created. We're really focusing our energy on a go-forward effort. The people who set the target may not even be here anymore. So in some cases, some information may be available, but I'm a little bit worried about being able to provide you the level of detail that you may be looking for. I think.
Well, that's part of what I'm looking for, because actually that's what I thought was going to be part of the answer. Sometimes I ask a question when I know the answer.
Yes.
But I do think that, you know, that is important, because they're on our sheets every month. And that's what we're measuring against, and not understanding what that is critical. And so if we're going to revamp these, we need to have a serious conversation as to what outcome we're hoping to get from these. It's not a pass-fail measurement, but how we can improve the system moving forward. And looking at old antiquated numbers that may have worked years ago when the system was newer, when we didn't have the maintenance issues, when we didn't have some of the other challenges that we have, may not be a fair starting point of which to measure what we're doing in the field.
Yeah, and as an example, you know, we talked about rail on-time performance in the past, in past meetings. The current target for rail on-time performance was established assuming automatic operations, and we know that pretty much there's about a 5% decline in on-time due to manual operations. So that's one consideration, the type of thing we would think about the current operating environment in setting the targets. But again, kind of looking forward, we're looking at industry best practices, and in the highway industry, they're pretty far advanced in performance management target setting, so we're looking to some of those methods and establishing what steps you should take, what considerations should go into setting a target that makes sense internally, as well as from a public perspective, political perspective, you know, considering financial issues and so on.
Yeah, I do think it's time to recalibrate all of these, and also to be very clear as a board what we're using these numbers for, and that is to improve the service, not as an instrument to hang over somebody this month you didn't succeed, but rather for the board to have a conversation why and what we can do to fix that.
And I wanted to add also, as you know, we're meeting with you tomorrow in the orientation, and we're going to go into some detail about the board's role in performance management, so we can, I'll share some more of my ideas at that time.
Mr. Chairman, just to add one point to Mr. McKay's, if there are industry benchmarks that would be relevant, I think it would be helpful to see those. I know they're always different here and there, but If they exist, I'd like to know sort of where we fit in that spectrum.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I do want to echo what you said. I mean, this is a topic which is on the list that we're working on relative to governance committee, and there'll be more information about approaches we might use, but I appreciate very much hearing people's talk today, because I think that can influence how we approach it next week. The other thing that struck me as Ms. Burnside was presenting when she talked about the door, the sort of random door opening, is that one, probably of all of the things that are in here, is one where customer behavior is making the situation worse. And I don't know if we have thought about how we might begin to remind customers. There's an article, and somebody did an article about tweeting and how many people are tweeting while they're riding. I don't know if we've thought about tweeting back and saying, you know, we're really having trouble today. Don't lean on the doors. But I think as we look at these, you know, somebody else said, what's in our control? The weather's not in our control. Rider behavior isn't in our control. We can't remind Mother Nature, but we sure can remind the riders when their behavior is making a difference in in our success. And so I just put that idea out there.
And that might be especially a challenge during some seasons when you have a lot of tourists in town who aren't used to riding the train and assume it's like an elevator that pops open when you stick your hand in.
Any other comments? Mayor?
Yes, on page 58, there's statistics there for Fairfax County crime statistics. Maybe not crime statistics, but just statistics in general. Why only Fairfax, and when will the other jurisdictions, jurisdictional measures rather, when will other jurisdictions get there?
Some jurisdictions requested us to provide this data, and so we put it in here upon request. That's why it's Fairfax County.
Thank you.
I'm a firm believer in data. It doesn't set you free, but it sometimes helps. My favorite example in this report is the disparity between the 4,000 series car breakdown rate and all the other series. The 4,000 series breaks down twice as often in terms of mean miles between failure. I think the next highest breakdown is the series 1,000, which is about 40,000 miles between breakdown, and the series 4,000 is 26,000 miles between breakdown. You have to keep asking the question, is there any way to fix the 4,000 series cars, or are we just hung with these dogs of cars for the rest of their useful life? You buy a Yugo, you get a Yugo.
No. One thing to set these cars also apart is they still have DC propulsion, and that is a big performance issue. Everything else that we have here has AC drive. We are in parts obsolescence. We are in systems that, you know, manufacturers no longer exist. They do make up our fleet, so we must, you know, continue to sustain them. We are focused on areas of trying to find suppliers outside of the United States and inside that make some of the parts and the materials, and we're going through a lot of reverse engineering. I wish that I had a little bit more pleasant story or positive news, but they will continue to be a big challenge on our part. We kind of like what we focused on the 1000 series with air conditioning and modifications to control panels and everything else. We are putting together a list of items that we'll be looking at from a capital perspective to replace some of these known subsystems that are giving us, you know, some problems and some issues. For example, newer type of air compressors, auxiliary power supplies that we've done elsewhere. But we have been very, very focused on the 1000s, getting the 2s and 3s in, 5s and 6s. And it's, again, further compounded on their use because beforehand we were able to kind of marry them together, you know, but now with the new requirement, when you have to run everything mixed, it just adds another venue to it that makes it very difficult. Like I said, the DC propulsion is the big challenge right there from a reliability standpoint. Yeah, and the other thing is they have never been overhauled.
Anyway, looking at the clock and knowing that there are several other non-controversial items on the agenda, we should probably move on. Hearing no other about performance, let's move to escalator performance.
Okay, this will be a joint presentation between Ms. Burnside and myself, and so I'll go ahead and let her lead off.
Thank you. First slide, please. Okay, before we get started, we just wanted to give kind of a context for the escalator. Oops, got a little feedback there. The escalator program here at Metro, we have the most escalators at 588 and elevators at 237 of any transit system in North America. That's significant. These were installed starting in 1976 up to 2004. Multiple manufacturers, many of them no longer in business. In fact, a majority of them no longer in business. There's no standardized size or length installed. Some are very long, some are short. Stairs are not available adjacent to all escalators. In many stations, stairs are not an option, as you know. And kind of as a lead into the rest of the presentation, the elevators and escalators are sometimes out of service for safety, repair, and scheduled maintenance. I'm going to go into detail on that. The profile of our elevator escalator maintenance group has been raised in the last year as out-of-service escalators frustrate our riders, and October's L'Enfant Plaza accident raised important questions about safety. This presentation responds to recent requests from the board and committees on information about what the escalator system availability measure provided in the vital signs actually portrays. We've heard customers look at it and say, we don't really believe this. So we want to kind of lead through what builds up to that measure. Additional measures that indicate to the board whether performance is getting better or not. I believe that was asked in October. What kind of escalator maintenance work is being done currently? And how are we progressing on the different actions to improve performance, including implementing recommendations from what's known as the VTX assessment of the escalator program and in response to the L'Enfant Plaza accident? Monthly vital signs report will continue to provide the board with a very high-level system-wide view showing the overall availability of escalators. This presentation provides an in-depth perspective on escalator performance. Ellis, that's Elevator and Escalator Group, will come back to the board in 6 months from now with a report on progress on the things that we're going to talk about today. We don't believe doing a monthly report to you would be that valuable because change takes some time. So we think progress can be shown, some significant progress in 6 months. So we'll now walk through a series of graphics to illustrate the overall system escalator availability measure, starting with the customer's experience. Next slide, please. A newly revised escalator elevator service status page on WMATA.com provides real-time information on equipment availability. So customers can go onto our site and take a look at this. It's updated 24/7 to reflect outages and service restoration as reported to the Escalator Elevator Operations Center by station managers and maintenance staff who are on-site in stations. At the moment, above, so it's a snapshot in time, on January 11th, 2011 at 6:30 a.m., 521 or 89% of escalators were operating and 228 or 96% of elevators were operating, as an example. We wanted to provide a real-time summary of availability and why units are out of service. But more importantly, as a customer, they can click on a station and find out availability where they're traveling. So if you're going through Vienna to Metro Center to Judiciary Square, which would be my trip, you can see exactly what's going to happen on your trip. This would not be displayed in vital signs. So for example, at Metro Center, of the 25 escalators available, 6 were out of service in this screen here for reasons listed, and we also list the expected return to service date. We feel it's important to provide this real-time information to the customer, but an escalator management measure needs to take a more of a system-wide perspective. Next slide.
Mr. Chairman, can I ask just a quick question about that? Ms. Burnside, does that read on a PDA, the slide previously, that where I'm looking to try to find my trip and stuff, does it work?
I am not sure about the answer to that. I haven't tried to do that myself.
I'd really like to know the answer to that question.
Okay. Maybe somebody by the end of this presentation can answer that for you. Thank you.
Okay. I also would suggest that while we're trying to put more access customers into the main service environment, for a lot of those people, real-time information is critical about trip choice. It would be good to query that community about the value of real-time communication directly to them if they sign up for a service that they want to know about individual elevator, escalator availability, that they can receive that in real time. That's not a big technology leap. A lot of
people can access availability of various parts of the system real time. We ought to do a special outreach to our access community about the type of information that they think makes sense real time on a specific notification basis. I don't think that's a difficult service to provide. It might help manage part of this system.
Thanks. Go ahead. Okay, moving to the next slide, and I would like to say that this graphic here is not something that would be seen on any website or is used anywhere on a regular basis, just to illustrate for today's presentation. So if you're looking for this elsewhere, you won't find it. So the previous slide showed a snapshot in time. To illustrate outages over the course of a few days, we look at one station as an example, Metro Center, over 3 days in December. So looking at December 12, 13, and 14. This station is one of our busiest and also has a large number of escalators. Depending on when a customer travels through Metro Center, they could encounter a different number of available units. This is because of units that are out for a few hours versus all day. The graphic depicts that reality. So it shows units staying in service for the full day, which is the green kind of color. The orange color. Units out of service for planned repair and units going out of service unexpectedly. This perspective is provided, as I said, to illustrate only. It will not be repeated because it's not a tool for escalator management or policymaking. We wanted to show that units go in and out of service between days and within a day. So this is why we calculate availability based on hours versus days. In the next slide, we'll move to looking at more than one station over the course of a month.
Just a question.
Yes, Mr. McKay.
On this last slide, that's not necessarily, you haven't reviewed one escalator. That may be one out of the 25 in the station at a given time.
These
all the escalators. So that's all of them.
That's all of them. So on this date, these are all the escalators, and this shows you the status of each.
So they're the same as you go down. They're in the same
order. Yeah, this
order.
Is the same one.
So when
still,
you have those
still,
out, for those, that's one escalator out for three whole days. And right. Then that large gap where there's none is escalators the same days that are having no problem.
That's correct.
Okay.
Mr. Giancola?
Yeah, related to that, I think a more important question is typically, and looking at the green shaded ones, what is the typical reason they're going down? I mean, and using that station specifically, that day, all the temporary outages, what were they for? I mean, what was the preponderance of the reason it was out?
We're going to go into some more detail on that a little bit further in the presentation.
Oh, okay. I thought you were concentrating on that sample. Okay.
I actually don't know exactly the reason for this sample, so we'll talk more in general.
I'll wait.
Okay. Okay, so this next slide looks at availability at multiple stations by month, and I will say this is sort of a five-part slide, so I'm going to layer in because it's a complicated slide if you just look at it all at once. So in this slide, we're going to focus on the top stations for 1 month. Why focus on the top stations? And I say top 20 stations. This is where the majority of the customers are. The top 20 stations represent 51% of weekday entries and exits, and this is looking at December 2010, and 43% of system-wide escalators. Before I put the first layer on, I want to show you that this graphic will show us monthly availability. So on this axis here, the vertical axis, it shows you the percentage of availability, and up is good, 100% being at the top, 0 being at the bottom. On the bottom axis, the horizontal axis, it shows the number of escalators in a station. So this is would represent kind of smaller stations over here. You go over to the right, you're looking at some of our biggest stations having the most escalators. So the system-wide escalator availability average for December was 88.6%. You'll now see the variation by station. The next layer shows us our busiest stations, if you can add that in the blue color. So the color blue, as well as the size of the bubble, shows you the busiest, the size of the station in terms of how many entries and exits. So these stations in blue represent 36 to 56,000 entries and exits on average weekday in December 22. L'Enfant Plaza, many escalators, serving many customers well. So you can see L'Enfant Plaza up here, over there. You can see that being up kind of in this quadrant is good. You're pretty up high, and you have many escalators. Farragut West and Farragut North have fewer escalators, but are serving customers pretty well. And DuPont Circle, right here, has a number of escalators, sort of mid-range, but is not really kind of as high as we'd like it to be, and we hear a lot about DuPont Circle. If you could put the next layer up, please. This shows us stations in the green with 25,000 to 36,000 entries and exits on the average weekday in December 2010. So Rosalind has a few escalators serving, let's see, Rosalind is top. Yeah, right there. Serving customers very well. Foggy Bottom has few escalators and is serving fewer customers not well. And as you know, we're replacing those escalators and putting stairs in there. Now moving to the fourth layer, which is in hot pink, I believe. This shows us stations with 19,000 to 25,000 entries and exits on an average weekday in December 2010. And naturally, they're going to fall over this side because they're smaller stations. They don't have as many escalators. And doing fairly well on some and not so well on others. So this puts a lot of information onto one graphic. Overall, saying of the top 20 stations, 10 are above 90%. 10 are from 80 to 89%. The highest for December was Rosalind at 98.6%. The lowest was Foggy Bottom at 80%. This contains useful information, but to manage all of our escalators, we need to conduct trend analysis. Next slide. So now we're at the vital signs level, which is the highest level of kind of a system-wide look, to provide the board with a strategic view of system-wide performance. In December, escalator performance picked up to 88.6%, as I said, following completion of break inspections that were conducted in November. Ongoing maintenance is required to keep the system going, obviously. While some maintenance can be done while the system is closed, certain repairs must be done during the day while customers are in the system. And you could compare this to repairing rail cars or buses that go out of service. You pull those off into a yard somewhere, but you can't do that with an escalator. It's right out there in the public, in everybody's face every day as it gets repaired. The target is 93% for escalator availability to account for these kind of repairs. This is an historical target. We talked about targets in the last presentation. And Metro is doing analysis now to see what an appropriate target would be, given where we are now. We'll follow the guidelines presented earlier in the target setting methodology, best practices. The next question we would raise is, how are we maintaining our escalators? So now I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Kubicek, who will present an overview of what types of maintenance are occurring during the day. So this is not when the stations are closed, but during the day when customers are going to see it. He'll discuss the different maintenance activity level performance measures, kind of deeper down level measures, and also the actions being taken to address the performance.
Okay, thank you. What this right in here is representing is probably a little bit greater breakdown in what we're trying to populate and trend utilizing our maintenance database, which is Maximo, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. That'll probably pop up in some of those discussions that we have. It's very important that we start classifying these type of failures much more effectively, so that way not only is it the communication externally to the customer, so that way if they're looking at an app or a website or whatever, but also internally, so that way we're 100% focused on the accuracy of our information that's being inputted by our staff. As you can see, this is just a kind of a quick snapshot of, you know, scheduled maintenance, unscheduled maintenance, you know, our safety repairs, minor and major work, and also, you know, with customer incidents. We've broken it down at this level. There's probably other, within each one of these subsets, there's different assigned breakdowns or potential fault codes that roll up into these major categories. So for us, we're just trying to simplify it as much as possible. On the scheduled repairs, again, that really ties in with our, you know, capital program or preventative maintenance. The unscheduled is, again, whenever we might have a handrail that comes dislodged, a switch or whatever that might be tripped off, they'll immediately classify that, you know, accordingly. Safety repair, that is whatever we do put that in the category now, because we want, whenever we're going through these inspections, if we find something deficient and stuff during that inspection, then we just hold it out until that thing actually gets repaired, because we want to start trending that information on what the technicians are finding out there. Minor and major repairs, those are generally just, you know, follow-up type work that necessarily wasn't holding the unit out for a long time, but we do want to go ahead and try to start figuring out if they go in and they change out some hardware or lights or something like that, to start classifying what we're doing and why we're doing it. And then the customer incident, that's again, just a standalone. If we have a particular incident where somebody, you know, slips or falls, you know, we shut down that unit and stuff, that goes into a whole other category itself, because depending upon the severity of the incident, we could either restore that unit after we complete our investigation, or if there was somebody who was actually transported or hurt, then that unit actually stays out until a review is done, and then the appropriate jurisdiction also gets involved, and they are actually the final party that allows us to restore that unit back into service.
Yes, Mr. Downing.
Just want to be sure I understand. When an escalator is shut down but still available to be worked on, as sort of corresponding with one other in the set, that is classified as an outage?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And the other component to clarify, if we're doing a capital project and we have one unit that is operating, the one unit that is being overhauled and the adjacent unit is held down, we hold that against ourselves because it's not performing.
So from the customer's point of view.
Yeah, from a customer's perspective, a unit is not working. It's not operating either up or down, regardless of the configuration. So that's why we do take a lot of hits whenever we get into stations where, especially in the lower levels where you only have two escalators. So that is just part of the process. And as we keep trying to, as we approach this, especially with our staff, it's about the customer experience and the mobility throughout our system.
But as we set targets, we have to take that into account.
Yes, yes. Okay, next slide, please. Okay, this is some information here as it gets into the overall, you know, breaking down of the system as far as mean distance between, you know, the failures. And, you know, this is definitely not trending in the right direction, but it's something that we're pulling together so that way we have some measures and stuff that we can start sharing with our staff and also reaching out to all parties that are involved in this. There are, you know, some reasons why on failures, as we went through the previous slides, you're looking at certain technology, certain ages of equipment. You know, maybe it's parts obsolescence and stuff, and we'll talk a little bit more in the presentation on that as well. But this for us is just another a hardcore fact that, again, this is what the customer impact is, and what this is what they see whenever they're going through our system. And so from a measuring standpoint, while there is a lot of variables and everything else, I think this is a very powerful display to really get our staff's attention, ourselves, to say we've got to get this number going in the other direction. And again, we'll be looking at this as we work with Andrea's group and we establish other departmental goals. This is something that, you know, we think that the forefront hasn't been applied, but now is a great time for us to use this on a regular basis. Next slide, please.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
I don't have a final answer right now. As we start pulling this information, you know, together, I think as we're kind of profiling the types of equipment and stuff that we have, and later on in the presentation, you're going to see where we have some units where we have very few of them, but their reliability is very, very bad. And then you have other areas where we have a large number and their availability is fairly accurate. So I'm a little hesitant to put out a number at this point in time. course, we'll always take more staff if you're willing to give them to us, but I know that that's a challenge in today's timeframe.
But ultimately, when Dave gets finished with this analysis, it's understanding what resources we have to apply to improve this as part of his end results of his analysis.
Yeah, in fact, we only have two suppliers that still exist out of the seven that we have. And there's one of them that we won't comment on, but they're in shaky ground as well.
So then that increases the delay?
Absolutely.
Ms. Chairman?
Yes.
Mr. Kubitschek, you mentioned on the slide before that when you have to take the partner escalator out, you count that against ourselves. Does this mean time between failure also include take the partner or only the escalator that's broken?
Only the escalator that's actually down.
Okay, thanks.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Do you, are all escalators treated equally? I mean, are some more equal than others, like at Woodley Park where we have such a long escalator and a lot of, you know, strollers and elderly. Are they treated differently or are they treated as just units?
As we go through this, working with this data and just overall the review, we're really going to have to adjust our approach on the way that these escalators are actually maintained because of equipment type, how they're set up. And then also, we are doing kind of like an assessment on how the equipment is actually being operated. I'll go ahead and I'll talk about that at this time. It's one of the things that we're also finding is that from a review standpoint, if we have escalators, say for instance we have three escalators that go up to the street level, there's a tendency over the years that we have a lot of switching and turning off of escalators where they'll turn them off. Then they'll redirect them, you know, course of midday or several days. That in itself is causing some of damage, and it also leads to failures. So, for example, like if we have an escalator bank where we have three, what we're starting to move towards is we want to have a direction towards. We would have two of them always operating in the up direction and a standpoint where we would only have a single one that would be going down. That's an ideal situation. The logic behind that is that, you know, from a mobility standpoint, it's a lot easier to walk downstairs than it is to go up them. Then the other component of that is as we continue to switch equipment on and off, and we're changing this, and we've got tons of equipment. Using Wheaton as an example, which is just really wearing us out, is that equipment, for example, it's the longest one that we have. It has no soft start motor controls. It has no basic amenities like we have on other systems. And whenever they turn that thing off, they really should let it sit there for several minutes and then try to restart it. But since of its age, when it tries to force up, we will tear up or damage, you know, gear units, drives, everything else. And so it's kind of like anything else, the less that we can touch it, and once we get it operating and working in a certain mode, we really want to work with that. But we're also very sensitive to the customer experience and also the flow of the stations. And so we do have a huge effort going station by station by station on how we should really be setting this equipment up.
But do you prioritize your stations?
Yes, we prioritize the stations from a standpoint of looking at our core stations, Metro Center, Lafont. And then we just working off of the numbers and the performance.
So you prioritize by the number of trips or the number of riders?
We're looking, as we deploy this next schedule, we are prioritizing by our worst performers in parallel with our highest volume.
Thank you.
Because we're looking for, again, to try to figure out how to get as much equipment readily available to the customers operating on a consistent basis versus them going through our system, and all of a sudden they have a unit that's not working that serves their needs.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, this right in here just kind of provides you a quick breakdown on, you know, our units. Like I said, Westinghouse and only two of the seven are really available that are really supported by an OEM. Some people have bought other folks out, but it gets very, very difficult in trying to get some of these obsolete parts. We're just, again, trying to give you an average age, the number of units and stuff that are deployed. And as you can see, the Westinghouse units, even though they're, you know, predominantly there was a lot of questions around them, all in all, they're performing very well. And then as you get down, where we get into these specialty units, or where they bought like a small segment of, you know, escalators just to fit a certain project or need, it really got us into a lot of trouble. And that's also why the line segment contracts, for example, on the red line and the orange blue line are so very powerful for us, because right now we're standardizing this equipment as much as possible and actually being able to develop it, go into the next generation of equipment, which we feel will be much more robust.
Question. Thank you. This is an interesting report. Knowing that we do have complex procurement regulations to abide by, by my count, there's 99 non-Westinghouse units in our system, and you can see the little small spurts of 8, 7, 9, 6 units. Is there any way we can consider in the future standardizing our fleet of elevators? I'm going to call elevators or escalators a fleet of escalators. So much like we do our equipment, if we can we standardize that to at least solve this multiple parts issue that you're dealing with?
To a point, yes, we are and we can. I mean, for example, a small quantity like at Foggy Bottom, that is a very unique system. That's part of the lower realm that is getting replaced right now. And so that is why, as we look at this in trying to establish these long-term contracts on the segments, if the vendor knows that they've got several units that they're going to be selling, it helps them program. And then the other component is we're trying to find, because there's fewer and fewer escalator companies that are really out there. And so, you know, our window of opportunity is also shrinking down. So whenever we go out with these larger contracts, it helps us ensure that we are dealing with a firm that has the volume, the capacity, and hopefully the longevity. Not to say that even the big ones won't go out, but we are looking at an equipment profile.
Well, we are doing rehabs in future years. And,
yes.
And I'm thinking that in some cases, some of the rehabs, as you described in previous briefings, are basically replacing the whole unit.
Mm-hmm.
And the real question is, okay, if we're at that point, why don't we start to standardize some of these?
Through this process and through some of the technology upgrade, we're absolutely doing that. Absolutely. And like, again, just to use Foggy Bottom, that's like 100% replacement, you know, from top to bottom. So, you know, we're not using the chassis or whatever. It's totally it'll be the most robust escalator assembly that we'll have out there, the latest technology. And also the other thing that we've also found that's been very interesting is when the equipment is actually bought in its life cycle. Because when you go into technically qualified, low bid, sometimes they will sell you something that is technically qualified and it's the cheapest, but if it only has 3 or 4 years left in its service life to be supported by the industry, it's helped. We were looking at our evaluation criteria a little bit different to make sure that it is, you know, it's got another 15 or 20 plus years, so that way we can get through there. That's one of the biggest observations I've seen here as well is and that's a pitfall, but it's just one of the things that we've also, lessons learned, and we'll move forward on it.
Keep going. Yes.
All right. Mr. Kubitschek, the last thing on that slide said escalators located inside stations operate almost twice as long as outside uncovered escalators.
Yes.
Do we have a plan to cover everything, or is...
Well, we did. We canceled it.
You canceled it? Well, yeah. I'm just, you know, we're spending a lot of money.
Yes.
And we're going to upgrade a lot of escalators. And we're still going to have uncovered escalators. And I suspect new ones will continue to wear out more quickly than ones that are covered. So it seems to me covering has to be part of our long-range plan, is it?
Yes, we will be coming back on a regular basis, like I said, talking about our capital, looking at our expenditures on what's taking place. For example, the other thing that we would ask y'all, the board, to help us is because every jurisdiction has a little bit different criteria for requirements, regulations. Now, for Foggy Bottom, in that area with the district and stuff, they worked great with us, but there was a lot of major players, and we did have to do a lot of outreach because of the hospital and everything else that's around there. You have to make sure that you satisfy and meet a lot of people's needs. So there's a lot of front-end work that goes on just for a simple canopy. But absolutely, as we were looking at the numbers and even the type of design, maybe changing it a little bit to make sure that it does a little bit better protection than what we have now.
Mr. Downing?
Following up on canopies, do we have data to show that the stations with canopies actually perform better?
We have data. We do have data that we are assembling to provide a little bit clearer picture. It definitely comes across that the 100% covered that are inside, you know, definitely last longer because of the elements. But as we go through this Maximo system and we're in some of the recommendations, I don't want to use skewed damage, you know, as we talk about this since we're going on record. But what we're seeing,
the canopy is certainly a benefit for the customer.
Absolutely.
But
absolutely.
I'm wondering if it really benefits the escalators at all.
No other questions. We go to the next slide. As I said, we got a lot of other details here. Next slide, please.
Low battery.
Low battery. Is it okay if we just do this the paper way and until technology catches up with us?
Keep going.
Okay. The next slide is basically, you know, how fast are we actually getting escalators, you know, back into service? And again, you know, people ask, whenever we were putting this stuff together, we got a lot of interesting pushback to say, you know, why are you looking at this? And we're, again, it goes back to the customer experience. How long is it truly taking us so that way we're going to have failures, we're going to have something that's going to occur, but most importantly, how fast are we responding, you know, to this? Again, you know, we'll get away from the parts and the preventative maintenance and everything else, but what are we doing internally to also look at this number? One of the things that we're also working with is with the local jurisdictions. One of the things that we found out is that whenever we do have units, whenever we're going through our major capital programs, whenever that unit goes through a major rehab, we have to get approval from the local jurisdictions. The jurisdictions sometimes they have different schedules, and so we're trying to work better to schedule the respective jurisdictional staff because we've seen where we've lost weeks of a unit that was typically ready to go, but we couldn't do it because we didn't have the final steel, a stamp of approval for us to move forward on that. That's just one item that we're working with. The other thing that we're all, and again, I view that as an internal item that WMATA must improve as we talk about scheduling and forecasting, because we post this information out there. We know when these units stuff are supposed to be coming back on board, so we need to be working with our peers adjacently throughout. The other component on how fast we're getting escalators back into service, in June, we started the process of, used to have where all of our technicians would report out of one location. Well, by the time you have a group of individuals that report out of one location and then they try to go to all of these stations and stuff, you just lost 45 minutes, 50 minutes, maybe even more. So what we've done differently there is we've already got five regions or five zones that are established. So that way our technicians are located closer to this equipment, so that way we reduce our impact on shift changes as well as they're able to mobilize. And long term, it's also going to be an effort on our part because we're going to start judging the five regions to see how they perform, just as another cross look, just to see, you know, if one region, it could be equipment-driven, it could be management, you know, driven, or it could be the amount of employees and stuff that we're staffing, but it's another tool that we think is very, very powerful. Okay. The next one is the preventative maintenance compliance. We had showed one on the elevator last month, and so this one is on the escalator. Right now, for us, this is just totally unacceptable. This is data that's pulled, you know, out of Maximo, us trying to figure out what is really the right target, or actually where do we actually stand with our preventative maintenance. I will say this much, that, you know, some of the dips and some of the lower items, for example, whenever we did the brake review where we did halt preventative maintenance altogether, drove this. But to be honest with you, on my review, and we're still looking at the data, I was really surprised that it didn't drop it even further. Because whenever you do halt that effort, you know, you would think that you would see a much more severe spike in the performance of this. The inspections, the other thing that we've done on this is on our aligning of our staff and our inspectors. We found also that the biggest thing is us doing seasonal maintenance work as well. We're going to flip the way that this work is being done. Prior approaches have been to do all of the, say, for instance, the interior units during the summer months and the exterior units during the winter months. Well, for me, that's not exactly a most appealing working environment. So it would seem like that while it would be hot and maybe a little bit uncomfortable, that if we start doing some of this work out during the summertime or the spring or whatever, one, we'll get the work and stuff done timely, and we'll probably get a little bit better review. And then whenever we're in the cold winter months or whatever, then we would be able to work underground, which is a little bit more appealing. And that has a big issue and big impact on our overall morale and the logistics and also the way that we approach things. Also, part of the exterior side of this would be also to look at the maintaining of escalators on a seasonal basis as well. You know, getting towards the fall, getting stuff prepped up for winter and everything else where you have a lot of leaves and other materials and stuff that come in there, to start looking at these potential items, these external, I guess you could say, products that do, you know, cause issues with our equipment. So that'll be the next step as we work on this, is to start saying, you know, this is how we need to phase this. And a lot of this impact is coming, you know, from our technicians, you know, their communication, and that's a big, big key of this as well, is working closely with everybody on this effort.
What's the measure here? You've got percentages. Preventive maintenance compliance expresses a percentage. It's, what is a percentage of what?
Basically, the percentage is telling us that of a set schedule, and I'm not even working off of a standard at this time, but there is a inspection sequence, because everything is time-based. If you work solely off of this, this means based off of that time-based inspection, if they're supposed to be working this within a certain window, we're only achieving this about 40% of the time.
So it's on time and done when it's supposed to be on time, 40% of the time.
Yes.
It's not that only 40% of them get done.
No, it's basically we are not attaining our schedule. We are only actually achieving 40% on time for our inspections. Now, since it is time-based, you know, we've got stuff that's done monthly, stuff that is done quarterly. That's the next review that we're pulling back in to say, okay, we're not doing our quarterlies, but for whatever reason, we're hitting everything monthly. And then the other thing, working in this the Maximo data, is also to be able to track in and say, how many days are we really missing it? You know, is one difference on that. Again, it's not acceptable if we set the parameters, we miss it by one day. But if we're missing it by 30 or 40 days and it starts pushing the other cycle out and out, you're kind of in an area where you're just non-recoverable. And then you really have to, you know, intervene to say, we've got to change this direction altogether. So that's what this representation is. It's just to kind of give you all a snapshot of what we're seeing, and also to talk through on, you know, what were the appropriate steps that we're working for to get this addressed.
If I could, the actual equation for the percentage complaints is number of inspections completed divided by number of inspections scheduled.
Within X time frame?
Yeah, it would, it's a time-based event.
Mr. Jankola?
Okay, this is a chart that really concerns me a lot. Of course, reaching a 40% ability to meet our scheduled maintenance is a concern, and obviously you've recognized that, Mr. Kubitschek. But I'm reading ahead, and I'm wondering, okay, why is that? And I see later on you say realigning of staffing to improve efficiency, aggressively reducing vacancy rates, which I hadn't heard before, and adding more resources. I mean, are we really talking about additional staff as well to help in this area? I mean, there's a series of three questions.
Yeah. As I noted earlier, as it gets into staffing, we have a class that is underway right now to fill vacancies from a standpoint of technicians. We're aggressively recruiting for additional supervisors. That was previously commented in the Finance Committee where we had a compression issue where literally we were having supervisors that were saying, you know, why be a supervisor whenever I can go back to the floor and I make more money and I have basically, you know, less responsibility. I can just do my job and move forward on that.
And these are all budgeted items? These are all budgeted items?
These are existing budgeted items.
Okay.
Now, the other component, as I commented on early, as we go through this in-depth review and analysis, you know, what is the staffing number that we really should be at? You know, going back to the article that the Washington Post put together for Moscow, which is a great article for us, as, you know, 3,000 employees and a unlimited engineering and R&D, you know, setup would be great, but we know that's
unrealistic. Yeah, a lot of federal support in that.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we're talking of a staff that's less than 250. Of course, we do have, you know, contractors and everything else that are working with us, you know, as well, but when you're looking at core staff of that size, that's pretty remarkable. The other thing is to start looking at some benchmarking just to see what other systems or how they're staffing up, you know, their areas or whatever. We do come back, we'll be able to give you a very in-depth analysis of what's taking place and also to be able to compare maybe on some parallel the technology that they use in their system and why they're able to staff, you know, that appropriate level. But like I said, that's something that we'll be coming back to y'all on. But could we'd like to go to the next slide on the talk about the VTX assessment. The reason why the Maximo recommendations were kind of broken out is because in some of the previous slides, we know we really just don't want to have just data that just populates. We really want our data to transition into, you know, usable information that really flows up into a useful business model. The Maximo product in itself, whenever it was originally set up, when we use that in rail car maintenance, and you know, it's a global product. It's not a bad product. It's just the way that it's being applied and being set up that we're going to go in and spend some time to adjust it. The VTX report, while it did, you know, focus on stations, it was kind of a little sublip is that we always kind of commented we're going to be checking everything from top to bottom. And this was very, very powerful on our part because this is how we're able to communicate back to our technicians, our supervision, our management, and most importantly, to the customers to really be able to trend what has taken place so we're making very, very sound business decisions. Part of this also, there is five corrective action plans that we worked with our safety department, which will be escalated into the TOC reporting process. So those are what we view as very large safety items. Two of them, for example, one would be in relationship to the lighting quality that is in these areas in which these technicians work. The other one would be water migration, which is not only is it an issue for individuals that are standing in water working on 480 volts, a shock hazard and everything else, but it's also the mitigation of how that water is getting in and what else is it doing to our system. Not only just about the escalator, elevator, but there could be other electrical areas, power, everything else that we're looking at as well. So those are just, you know, two examples of that there. Okay. Actions to improve performance. We have hired a new general superintendent. He is coming on board very quickly, coming up to speed. We're reorganizing the Ellis Department a little bit from a standpoint of we have a capital-focused function group, which is small, but it manages and works with a lot of the contracts on we're working with our equipment. We now have a focus of maintenance and run and repair, a department head for that. The other component, which is probably one of the most critical one that we're looking at adding additional resources, is a technical services branch. We are looking to be able to reverse engineer or find alternate sources so that a way we can actually sustain this equipment internally, you know, ourselves to the best of our ability. That is one thing that's been lacking from this department from day one. They've just kind of installed stuff, and then they've just been able to kind of buy and buy and buy. But now you're dealing with equipment that is going to be around for decades. So you kind of have to apply the same thing that we're doing in traction power or rail cars or anything else. We have to have that mindset of technical services arm that is really there to support that equipment and to sustain the asset. Because, again, one thing that was also very powerful about the VTX report is that we didn't find any fatal flaws necessarily. It was really got surrounded around maintenance and basic functions and housekeeping. And that's very critical. So as long as we're maintaining this equipment properly and we're moving forward to have the right parts and materials, then it keeps us away from, you know, potential larger issues. Also on this right here, basically we also had a big, we continue to have a big feedback where I brought in a group to actually do interviews with the actual Ellis Department. We talk with employees, supervisors, management. There was one-on-one sessions. There was some team building. We actually did kind of a survey and stuff. We're putting that stuff together. So we really want to make sure that we hear at all levels and stuff, because it's going to take the team to really get this thing turned around. And that's been a very, very powerful process on our part. Again, developing the data across the board is, you know, the most important thing that we can do at this point in time to really be able to gauge everything. And to the earlier comment about, you know, does a one-size-all, you know, one-size-fit-all approach really work? It just doesn't really approach. An example that we've also seen from a safety perspective in our elevator our escalators is even our escalator units that have the glass panels on the side. A lot of people might not know this, but we have anywhere from 30 to 70 panes damaged on a regular basis. If that glass is kicked out, that holds that escalator, you know, out of service. Since that glass pane is a custom fit product, we cannot buy it off the shelf. So one of the things that we're looking at, because of service availability, and it'll get into codes and it'll get into lighting requirements, is just replace it with a nice stainless steel cover that's very durable, that's used, you know, and elsewhere. But it's those little bitty things that really cause a lot of issues. And the other concern on this glass and stuff, at least in our environment, is whenever that panel and stuff is busted and stuff, then, you know, not all of it's tempered where it just shatters all over the place. Some of this stuff breaks in bad environment where they'll shut it down and, you know, tape it up or just hold it out. So that's just another, like, little small detail. And whenever you have to disassemble an escalator for one piece of glass, then you have to take it to a firm, have them custom cut it based on dimensions, and then bring it back. You're looking at days, you know, and plus a huge expense.
Mr. Downey?
Yeah, in terms of focus, I would think there's another dimension. Some stations are far more escalator dependent than others. I can walk up 12 steps at one place, but if I'm in DuPont Circle, you cannot evacuate the station fast enough without those escalators. So I think there needs to be a priority for the places, Roslyn and others, that are really dependent for operations, higher standard of availability.
We 100% agree. That's why we're going through this assessment. You know, basically, if we can configure this equipment to let it run in a certain area, then, you know, rotate it maybe to make sure that it does have the ability to be reversed. But the less that we actually touch it, especially on these deep stations, it really makes no sense. And we're damaging the equipment, you know, through some of these processes. And our station managers have also been very responsive to this, because every station kind of gets a approached a little bit different, and, you know, they're also looking to us to say, we just want to know how we should be operating this configuration, and it also makes them more efficient whenever they communicate to the control center and everything else on how the unit is taking place. So it's a combined effort at all layers.
And in that planning process, I assume one thing we'd like to avoid is having only one escalator running and having it going down.
Absolutely. Okay. Again, on again, performance here, we discussed about the realignment of the staff. To also with vacancies to work on that. We do have a heavy recruitment process ongoing, and so all in all, with that right there, just to let you also know, for us, whenever we have a technical skills program to basically certify or qualify a technician, it is a four-year apprentice program. Okay. Now, we do have an area where there is a lot of on-the-job training, so we do get value of, you know, having these individuals, but it is a item that is a long lead time for us to really get a craft, you know, established, you know, with that. The other component on to talk a little bit more about our increase or escalator modernization, one of the things we're also looking at is that past practice was we would, you know, take out a bunch of escalators, they would start doing work, and they would have a contract they would set up and they would work, you know, everybody would work day shift and go home. On our part, I kind of have a little bit of a fundamental problem with that because since everything else is 24/7, it doesn't make sense to have all these units that are just being worked on 8 hours of the day whenever we could maybe look at multiple shifts. We're working through the contract process of changing the way that some of this work effort and stuff is taking place. So we're going to be maybe, I'm not going to say we're going to be reducing the number that we're actually going to be working on, but but it could trend just very slightly. But what we're looking at is as we vet and write our new contracts to say that we want to go ahead and, you know, we want 20 hours of work a day or 16 hours a day. We're also finding out that since that's negotiated a little bit more on the front end, some of our cost initiatives to contain costs and stuff, since they know this is taking place in a bid and stuff, has been very, very prudent for us. So what does that mean in the long run? Well, that means that, say, for instance, a unit that might take 12 to 16 weeks, you know, we might be able to knock it down into, you know, the 10-week time frame, if not even, you know, sooner. But then it also means that there's other escalators that could possibly be available, you know, if they're not in a unit where we just, or an area where we just have two.
Okay. I think you've covered most of the other issues. You've covered accountability, transparency, talked about increasing parts. And we'll be back in 6 months, not only with update the committee, but also the results of the DPX survey and evaluation as to whether we've made progress.
Could I make one suggestion? It's painful to watch PEPCO go through the accountability process. We don't have a very good story either about this, and the severity of the problem is not near what power outages do, but the anger at times is equal. I think it's important for the authority to acknowledge how we got here. We did a lot of stupid things about let's outsource. We had all of the maintenance in-house. We decided we'd try and push the majority of it outside, then we decided we'd bring it back. We underfunded this part of the authority's work. I'm incredibly pleased about the general manager's decision to have this outside evaluation, which gives us a roadmap going forward. We haven't told the story to the public about how much money we're going to be investing in escalators going forward, it explicitly as part of this. We haven't said what our performance targets are. For instance, for mean time to repair an unscheduled outage over the next 6 months, what the performance is that we are expecting of ourselves in this area about managing this set of issues. so that there is a way for the customer to hold us accountable about progress going forward. I think we all believe in accountability about specific performance. This is an area that needs some of that kind of definition about targets sooner rather than later. And the other suggestion I'd make, although I'm struck by a comment that Mr. Downey made, is that escalators aren't rocket science. We don't need to make this more complex than it is. Admitting that we bought some junk and we're replacing it is an important part of the story. We have to be able to say to the customer, these are the specific steps we're making. These are the targets that we're going to deliver to you as improvements in this area over the next 6 months and 12 months. I don't think that's out of the realm of possibility or reasonableness. It's an area where we could also, for instance, have a customer, if there is an unscheduled outage in a station, have somebody from customer service show up and look at a service plan, not just the engineering and the station manager folks, but somebody who can pay attention to the customer service needs about which escalators are up and which are down and which are going sideways, that we can have a visible commitment to the customer side of this in a way that we haven't so far.
On the contractor side, I think it would be worth looking to the pages of the Highway Guy's book on how you create incentive contracts. In fact, reward the contractor if they can beat the schedule. Penalize them if they can't. But
yes.
The incentive is there. They'll get it done.
Mr. Acosta.
Yeah, just to follow up on the chairman's comments about setting targets and all, is it reasonable to ask the staff to help us establish or to establish a six-month, a year, perhaps 18-month target for these three measures so we have some sense in terms of are we making improvements or not? And also, I think they could construct it so it's realistic, which I think if we did it ourselves, obviously, we would probably set expectations that could not be achieved. And that would be helpful if you brought that to us actually next month or the month after before you come back with a full report on how you're doing in 6 months. So I do think it's important because this is so visible and this is so so painful for many of our customers to deal with on a day-to-day basis that I think they are asking for results. And I think we need to establish some expectations that we believe we can deliver on. But I don't think necessarily we're in the best position to do that. I would ask that the staff come back and provide that the first shot at that.
Yes.
We'll do it with the proper analysis to back it up.
Good. I think it's always helpful to have a story we can communicate to customers, a media campaign, to not be apologetic or excusing ourselves, but to just be focused on communicating with our customers regularly and comprehensively about what we're doing here and winning back their confidence about this particular subject. Any other comment? Sergeant?
I think there's another part that I, when we say communicate with our customers, I think it would be good to speak with our customers as to how that communication, because I think there's a lot of communication and the story is told over and over, but you're right, it's not there. It's very clear that the frustration and the impact that this has on our customers is severe, and for some people, this is a denial of services for them. There are people who cannot use the service or are encumbered in such a way that it impacts them. But I think in developing that communication piece that we need to really talk to people and have them not only help us develop that communication, but to be our ambassadors in that communication. We have just gone through the approval of a policy to include greater voices from the disability and those that have impaired mobility and other issues. Let's hear how they not only feel about this, but also how best we can help communicate that message.
Yes.
I just wanted to answer your question about, can you see it on here? So we had different staff test it with different types of PDAs, some yes, some no. So we're going to ask IT to look at that and make sure that it's more universal.
Thank you.
Sure.
Any other discussions on this issue? Hearing none, we'll move on to something equally as non-controversial. Bag check. There is not a set of materials for this. This is an opportunity for the committee and the staff to have more of an open discussion about some of the issues that have been raised, pro and con, about bag check. And I want to preface it with what I think is an intent, a general intention of the board, that the board knew what it was doing when it granted to the general manager, in cooperation with his chief of police, the authority to make decisions that he felt appropriate about the protection of the safety of the customers of the system. What we've had are challenges about the general manager's judgment and authority, along with the chief, about that, and I don't think the board has much interest in having that discussion about either the general manager or the chief's judgment about the decisions that were made about the bag check processes. What I'd suggest, in a conversation I had with the general manager in preparation for this, was that we could talk profitably about our relationship as an authority in the board and the staff with our customers about these issues. The fear that I have is that without a dedicated commitment to hearing from our customers about heartfelt issues around privacy, their individual rights, and other concerns about security, we risk at times the TSA reaction about pat downs and full body scanners, and that led to a lot of pushback because there weren't ways of communicating very effectively between people who were going through that system and the Transportation Security Administration until it built to a sufficient enough head of steam that TSA agreed to modify the technology about full body scans. And we need mechanisms that we clearly say we value about having a discussion with our customers. These processes are to protect our customers. If they are there for that reason, they need to be part of this conversation. We haven't figured out the right mechanism for doing that, and we need to, if the integrity of this process is going to be perceived as fully open with our customers. There are obviously constraints about what can be put into the public realm about security for obvious reasons. There are obvious limits to what that discussion is. But those limits shouldn't preclude us from a honest, open effort to continue to communicate and receive feedback and have answers given to people who have matters of conscience and belief, beliefs about their privacy and their individual rights in this process. And that's how I got to framing this. And I know we've had, as a board, some discussion about these and wanted to have that conversation along with Rich and the chief about where we can go with the openness in this system. Everything should be on the table from, I think, focus groups, survey work, to website interaction. Their technology allows for a much broader and open dialogue in areas like this than it's ever had in the past. So,
Mr. Chairman, I very much agree with you that we certainly need to bring customers and their concerns more into these kinds of decisions. If the board, however, is going to declare that it has no impact on these decisions, then I'm not sure that we can do very much with the feedback that we receive. I would suggest that, in fact, there is a role for the board in these kinds of issues. I very much respect the chief, and I respect the general manager, the CEO, for the decisions that they have to make. These are difficult decisions. And there obviously is a law enforcement piece, a large law enforcement piece, in protecting the safety and security of the system. But there are larger issues than simply law enforcement in protecting the safety and security of the system, and I would submit that those larger issues are, in fact, the purview of the board. To a very great extent, our relationship with our riders has a significant impact on the safety of the system, and that relationship with our riders is a very important part of what we need to deal with as a board. So there may be certain issues that are technical issues, that are issues that are based purely on expertise, that I would be happy to rely on the expertise of the chief and the judgment of the CEO of the system. But anytime we're dealing with something that has this much impact on the rider experience in using the system, I think there is a role for the board to be involved.
Thank you, Mr. Downs. I think what we should review is that we are here because the board made a decision that, in response and under Mr. Wells' motion, that we wanted to address this from the relationship, as you spoke to, Ms. Porter, with our customers. And to me, I think the discussion is about, is there a larger policy decision that we have to delineate for our customers with our board, our CEO, about relationships? That is, we have granted authority, and in this case, it's not granted. It's the authority that exists within the role that the chief of police and the CEO must play in the decisions about this organization. And so in doing so, what's going to be our ongoing policy of how we work with our customers to understand that? And I think we need to delineate what that is. It is not the discussion of the decision, but how do we inform and help citizens recognize what will happen to them, how it affects them, how what we can do to help alleviate any concerns or stress about that, and maybe not appear dismissive from the decision as a board. I think that's important because while we may all have, in a sense, some sense of agreement in terms of what citizens feel and say, there needs to be a clarity as to what our role is as a board. And maybe we've missed that part. And for me, I think it's how do we move forward with our customers in this discussion? And that's a very important role for us.
Mr. Downing.
Thank you. I agree. We need to be communicating with our customers. I think we need to be listening to the broad range of all our customers, not perhaps some who shout louder than others. But we also have to recognize this goes beyond a law enforcement issue. This is a national security issue. The attractiveness of attacks against this system outweigh most every other part of American society, and it's probably, from experience that I've had dealing with these kinds of issues, one of the most difficult civil systems to provide security. I think we have to give a lot of latitude in order to meet that response. I don't want to find myself after an attack. And one of the things you have to think about in this world is there will be attacks. I don't want to find myself in front of a congressional committee or in front of a court saying, why did you not practice what had been suggested by people who are expert in the field of law enforcement and the field of national security? I think we have to think about that. It's a day that could definitely come, and it's not a place that I would like to be, and it's not a judgment where I think you can weigh and balance. I think how we approach it, how we use all the different tactics that are out there is important, but I don't think we can just pretend that there's not a problem, that there's not an issue, that there's not a risk, that there's not consequences that would come from that risk.
Catherine?
I guess with great respect to the board and its dedication to getting feedback from our customers, I think if we start off by saying, well, we want to hear from you, but the reason we want to hear from you is to reassure you and just tell you that it's going to be okay, I don't think we're going to get very meaningful feedback. I really think it has to be a dialogue and a discussion. We have to have their sense of what is important to them. And I have no doubt that safety is, in fact, important to them. But I also suspect that there are other things that are important to them also, and that they would ask us to weigh those things, to weigh the degree of safety, to weigh the various methods that we might use to accomplish that safety. For example, could we use the money that we received from this grant and instead hire additional officers that would be distributed throughout the system looking for suspicious actions, suspicious persons, suspicious packages? Might that be as or more effective than what we are doing currently with the money? That would be a question I would like to have a discussion of. I would like to have a discussion of that before it comes out as a stated policy.
And if we're going to have that discussion of effectiveness, I think we need to talk to people who understand effectiveness in terms of securing a system.
Mr. McKay?
Yeah, not really interested in rehashing my entire comments from the last time we spoke about this, but I will reiterate once again, and after our last conversation, I was accused of being a politician hiding behind, veiled threats. And frankly, you don't want politicians or a board of non-law enforcement agents to make this decision. So being accused of being a politician and then suggesting somehow that the board should do something and the politicians should decide this, I find quite humorous. I associate myself with Mort's comments. I don't know what we're getting at here. If we want to have a conversation about security, we ought to have that. The agenda item suggests somehow that this is dealing with bag searches. I thought we cleared up that the board is not making that decision, that the general manager and the police chief is. Then I hear, well, we should better communicate with our customers. The truth is, in this area, it's ever evolving. Right now, we're doing random bag searches. If a credible, meaningful threat comes in that requires our law enforcement agents to do something different tomorrow than bag searches to protect our customers, where was the public hearing? Where was the public input on that? I don't know what tomorrow brings, but if there's an expectation somehow that we're going to get public input and public hearings every time our police agencies and law enforcement decide they have to do something to protect our passengers, that's a wrong impression to have out there in the public. And I'm getting really worried that that's the direction that we're heading in. I'm not interested in doing that. I don't think it should be the role of the board to do that. I think it should be the role of our law enforcement agencies and our general manager, who we have deputized with this authority, to make those decisions to protect our passengers. As I said the last time, we're not privy to all of the law enforcement information that exists out there. And unless I was privy to all of that, I don't think I'd be in a position to make that decision. So if we want to have a larger conversation about public safety, we do that all the time at this board. We talk about crime statistics. We talk about all of those issues. We're not terrorism experts, and we ought not to act like terrorism experts. And I'm all for conversations about public safety, but I'm not for becoming the public safety law enforcement agents of this authority as board members.
Mr. Wells?
I have a little bit of a different take on the role of the board, and as we work through this, I mean, clearly we're loath to second-guess the general manager and the chief of police on a safety issue, but in terms of the role of the board and speaking on behalf of the community and the elected and appointed role that we have, that there is a continual balance of reasonableness. And the reasonableness in terms of the degree to which individual personal liberty is infringed upon in the name of public safety. And if it's not balanced at the board, then I guess it's tested elsewhere. But I think that the board has a role in helping to balance that. And so obviously we could all come up with extreme examples that of where security or our police decide to take certain steps that we believe in our society is unreasonable. And that's where I think the board as a policy level needs to be able to assure the public that we are applying some level of test of reasonableness and infringement of personal liberties when you choose to ride a system that for many people is not much of a choice, that many people are very dependent on our transit system in order to participate in their livelihood and elsewhere. So it's not like, you know, how much of their rights do they give up when they go through the metro doors? So I do think that when there are questions of reasonableness, that in a public forum like this, that it should be explained, tested, and it, whether it's a public hearing or if it's simply the board having a public meeting with our general manager, that these questions are highly appropriate. And I think that we do need to ask and also be prepared for any other measures that are looked to be implemented that will hopefully make the metro safer. I think that communication is extremely important. I think that it could be important as basic as when you enter metro, you had no idea there were going to be bag searches, and you wondered if we're now at code red, are they expecting and looking for bags? All of a sudden, they've heard that there's a bomb. What does this mean? Do they need to not ride metro that day? I think that there's a lot to be said for communicating clearly with the public about the safety measures we are taking on this public system, and it is a public system. So I started with, you know, clearly in our conversations together as a board, we're loath to second guess on a security issue. We don't want to be the one that prevented a security issue from being implemented and then something terrible happened. But at the same time, that threat and fear can't prevent us from exercising, you know, an expectation of standard. And so going forward, it is good for us to know, and I would ask Chief Tabord, what is the standard? That when, I mean, there's certainly many measures you could use, full body scans that we've heard about, you know, full ID checks before you go through. There is some type of level of how you choose to use a bag search one day versus something else. And so what standard is used by the police force?
Okay, if I could simplify the issue and move away from bag searches, knowing that in this area that Metro represents 1,500 square miles, 86 stations, over 1,300 buses, over 1,200 bus stops, over 65,000 parking spaces, platforms, school locations that we provide protection to, the question to me would be, how many police officers would be appropriate? And so if I had additional police officers, would it mean that I would not have to consider another method that sort of dissuades the bad person because of randomness, unpredictability, that we wouldn't have to do that? And so those are the types of questions that when we look at a momentary 18 seconds on average, looking on the outer portions of a person's garments, not looking into it, just to make sure that we do something similar to what's found in the Verizon Center or at museums across this area, with the understanding that we're doing it for the sole purpose of protecting our customers and employees in our facilities. And it's not an absolute guarantee that we will catch the bad guy, but is to add that unpredictability. We have canines, which is effective. We have police officers who randomly patrol. That is just one additional tool in our toolbox. And so if we were to be told that with this vast amount of coverage, if, as I've gone to meetings with Chief Lanier, community meetings, and we talk about the protection of the Metropolitan Police, which they do an outstanding job, but they cover 59 square miles, and she said that they had roughly 4,000 police officers, and I asked the community members, well, how many police officers do you think that we have? We cover 1,500 square miles. The answer is about 2,500, but that's not the reality. And so we depend greatly on the 40 federal, state, and local law enforcement agencies who every day do an outstanding job to assist us in protecting the employees and the patrons that utilize our system. But this measure is no different than the measure that many of you went through when you came to this building, that you were stopped and you were momentarily searched, or you had your items scanned. So it's
so. Let me just add, I think as Mr. McKay pointed out before, this is not a static situation. And the methods and the tactics that are employed by the bad guys and therefore by us evolve. So there is no standard, I don't believe. But what there is benchmarks, best practices. And in this case, this particular case, one of the best practices in terms of trying to, again, create this envelope of trying to deter terrorist attacks, adopted north of here in New York, which has suffered, you know, terrorist attacks, was, as one other item recommended, you know, by counterterrorism experts, was to have random bag searches. It's one additional piece in terms of what we do here. The history, as I understood it, was a couple years ago, there was an impression left by this board, preceding board, that random bag searches wouldn't occur. Rightly or wrongly, that was the impression left, not only with the public, but with staff. A couple months ago, 3 months ago, whatever, I got that clarified so that, in fact, it was not the correct impression. And talking about reacting to situations or making judgment, when the chief came back to me then to discuss this particular thing, I had in my mind concerns about violating people's constitutional rights. I had in my mind not causing queuing at a fair, just outside the fair turnstiles. I had in mind not being intrusive. And I also had in mind that we're coming up on the holiday season, which historically has been a time when people seem to want to do things, maybe for symbolic reasons, I can't guess their motivations. I also had in mind the fact that Times Square had a failed bombing attempt. Portland, there was something going on that was under control, thank God, because I guess it was the FBI monitoring. Here we had a couple of folks interested in doing something bad. My sense at that time was I'd rather be ahead of the game than behind the game. And if it meant moving quickly, and it meant moving quickly because I wanted to do this before the holiday season, and introduce something unpredictable, and to maybe throw people off, after we had gone through, in I'd say about a week or two's time, to figure out just what the tactics should be, refine it, so we would not delay people, we would not be intrusive, and we would not violate their constitutional rights. I made the decision to do this because I just felt in my judgment it was a time to do it. Now, I agree that given more time, and if I'm feeling relaxed about it, it's good to get public input. You know that I like to get public input. You know, we can talk about other things, customer relations. I like to do that. But I could face tomorrow something that comes to me that says, we got to do something. And I don't know exactly what it will be that we have to do to respond to it. But by God, I'm going to make that decision, and we're going to do it. But again, I'd like the customer input when I have the time to do it.
Well, all due respect, let me just finish this by saying that, Chief Tabard, I really appreciate that you expressed what I believe is a standard. You asked, is this reasonable? Well, it's something that we experience when we go to ball games at the Verizon Center. You looked at in terms of what we would view and is it a reasonable action. Then the other thing you looked at is a function of your manpower, about the deployment for how you cover and of, you know, this area and the number of people you protect, and would this help you with that? And so I appreciate that you've articulated a standard, and that is, you know, that's what I'm asking as a board, and I believe you've done that, and I appreciate that. Thank you. Ms. Sherwin?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I actually agree with some component of pretty much what everyone has said here, but only some component. What's really clear here is we're grappling with a very, very difficult issue, a very, very difficult issue. And it is a balancing act, as Mr. Wells indicated. We're trying to balance what's reasonable and what's imperative for the safety of our customers, and versus not violating their constitutional rights, not being too intrusive. And I don't know what the perception is out here with our customers, but it's one of the things that I grappled with extensively because I wanted to make sure we were not being too intrusive. I wanted to make sure we wouldn't have that queuing that Mr. Sarles just discussed. I wanted to make sure that we weren't profiling in any way, shape, or form. I wanted to make sure that we weren't intruding on people's time, that it would, and I think what distinguishes this from some of the other examples that were cited was that everybody gets searched. Everybody knows if you're going to the Verizon Center, if you have a pocketbook, they're going to search it. If, you know, everybody's going through something. This is random, but I do think it's consistent with the best practices. I just went to New York this weekend and returned, and I rode on Amtrak. While I was waiting on the platform, I heard the announcement informing everyone you're subject to random bag searches. You know, I think you have the expertise and have consulted with other transit agencies and other public safety entities, and I think I can't second guess you on this. I also know that we discussed this some time ago at the last presidential inauguration, that there were some concerns at that time as well. And you don't have the time to come back to us every single time, and you have to exercise that judgment. So we're still grappling. I personally am still grappling, but I am less concerned now, or more in terms of learning that the intrusion is not that great. It's no one's going through a great big physical search. No one's going through pat downs. No one's going through, you know, when people are in their hurry trying to get to work, they're not going to be taken aside for 15, 20, 30 minutes, you know, just for a regular random pat, you know, random search. So I don't think it's that intrusive. Yet I don't like any type of intrusion, but I do think when you balance it against the safety of our customers, as Mr. Downey indicated, how would you feel if you weren't doing anything and then something, God forbid, does happen? And they say, well, where were you? Were you asleep at the switch? Were you not concerned about the safety of your customers? So you're balancing all those competing interests. And I think on balance, I don't have a problem with the type of search that has been conducted. I don't know that that's been explained to the public as well. And I don't know that I'd rather err on the side of safety in this instance, as long as we are not profiling, as long as we are not too intrusive, and as long as that we're being reasonable in its implementation.
Ms. Hines?
A lot of good comments here. You know, I think the reason I was interested in bringing this to this committee is that I think what is that issue here, and I said this last time, is where's the line between the board and the general manager? And how do we communicate to folks the guidance that we give as opposed to the specific permission? And what I've heard both the chief say and the general manager and Ms. Hewlett echoed some and Tommy did too, is beginning to emerge as a set of policy guidance statements around this issue that perhaps the board could put into a resolution, because the tools are going to change. The circumstance is going to change. And I think what we've begun to articulate here are, you know, in the day-to-day operations, these kinds of things are okay. You have full permission. Maybe if there's something that becomes highly intrusive, I think we're all saying that, you know, if we had to go to pat downs, if we had to stop everybody, the board would want to be engaged in some way on how that's packaged and how that's put out there and how we do those kinds of things. But I offer that. You know, I think we do have an obligation to our customers. I also think we hold in public trust the ongoing safe operations of the system. And if this system fails, our region fails. And that, to me, also comes into this calculation, too. I ride the system. I have to spend 18 minutes getting my bag swabbed. I know that randomness is part of keeping our system working, and that's really important to me. And it is, as Tommy said, it's that balance between the individual and the region that is, I think, of very tricky.
Mr. Benjamin?
I am a long-term member of the American Civil Liberties Union. Many of my friends consider me a civil liberties nut. It is exceptionally important to me for us to respect in every possible way the rights that we have as citizens of this country, because that's what makes this country what it is. It is extremely important for all of us to protect those rights, because that's why we are the great country that we are. And I personally feel that bag checks are a violation of those rights. And it is the beginning of a process that moves towards us having fewer and fewer and fewer of those rights. And if this decision were only for me and only about me, I would say I personally am willing to take the risk of potentially having somebody get into the system and blow something up, and I would be one of the victims, and I would balance that against my rights and say my rights are much more important. And I would do that in the context that I truly believe that although this technique is valuable, it probably is not as valuable as I would like it to be relative to my rights. However, I'm also a member of this board, and I was sworn to protect the safety and the security of the people who ride our system. And I don't know how I, as an individual with good conscience, could allow somebody to get into our system, cause an explosion, and know that somehow or other I contributed to that by overruling the best judgments of our chief executive officer and the professionals who understand this process. And so I have an ethical and moral dilemma. If I were the only person riding, I know what I would do.
but I'm not the only person riding. I am required to think about all of those other people who haven't told us where they are. Yes, we had a hearing, both Ms. Hines and I went, which our Riders Advisory Council held, and the position was overwhelmingly, don't do this now. And we have a finding from our Riders Advisory Council towards us, two statements that they've made that say, don't do this now. But I don't know that I can be in a position of saying that I have got the ability, given the responsibility that is given to me as an individual and as a member of this board, to protect our riders, to say that they should take the same risk that perhaps I would be willing to take. And as long as I have to carry out that responsibility, I think I need to defer to those who believe that they understand better this issue. It's one that I do very reluctantly, but it's one that I do after very, very careful thought. And I think that's the balance that each of us needs to make as we consider this issue. Yes.
Let me just, it sounds like this discussion is wrapping up, and I would just like to clarify a couple of things at the end here. One is, my understanding from the chief is that this action was not undertaken in response to a specific threat. And obviously, if there were a specific threat directed against the system, we would all want the general manager to take immediate action, whatever immediate action was necessary. So I think we're talking about something where we do have an opportunity to have a longer discussion if we so chose. The second thing that I wanted to say is I would appreciate some delineation of where the board thinks its responsibility for discussing these kinds of issues would begin. I mean, if the chief were to, Mr. Wells mentioned, if we were to get a recommendation or the chief were to implement, the CEO were to implement, you know, full body scans, would we want to be consulted before that happened? If we were going to make everyone who entered the system produce an ID and somehow computer check it against some database, would we want to know before that happened? I mean, there must be a line somewhere where the board thinks that the reasonableness criteria is not being met. And I think that that's worth having a discussion about, because some people on the board feel that this meets a reasonableness criteria. I guess I have more questions about that. But I'm a little bit leery of, in the absence of taking an action that responds to a specific threat, or sort of giving the general manager sort of carte blanche, if it's security related, do whatever you like. I mean, I think we really need to think about some way that we get involved in those kinds of discussions.
Yeah, Indy.
I think there would be much opportunity for that kind of discussion, because most of the things that you would be fearful of would require funding to put in place, procedures to put in place. But I would not want to take away from the CEO and the chief the ability to do what will need to be done. Frankly, if there were a specific and credible threat, I would like them to have the ability to shut the system down. We may have to do that. We may have to do that. But we shouldn't tie their hands to what, in the interest of all our riders, they would have to do.
Can I just clarify? I'm not talking about a case where there's a specific and credible threat. I mean, I think there's nobody on this board that wouldn't, including myself, who wouldn't give the general manager the authority to do whatever he thought necessary in the face of a specific threat. I'm talking about in cases where there's a general security concern.
And there is a general security concern. It is pervasive. And it's my view that what we're undertaking now is a minimal but certainly acceptable response, and well within the bounds of what has been tested in the courts. This is less intrusive than what is being done 600 times a week on the New York City subway system. It's less intrusive that's being done in other places, and it is recognized by security professionals as a useful, but not certainly a dispositive step to taking the terrorists off their game, shifting their plans, implementing what or affecting what their thinking might be. And this is from people who think all day long about what makes terrorists tick and what would make them take their business elsewhere or not undertake them. I think we're well within what we should be doing. I don't think there's any proposal out here that we're going to have full body scans. But I also will tell you, I lived through 8 years of airport and airline security where we were pushed back day after day, week after week by the airlines and by passengers. And within weeks after an event that we all remember, we wound up with the TSA running a security system that had nothing to do with making the system work. I don't want to be there either. I think we have to take the reasonable steps so that if something happens, we know why it happened, we know where the system may have failed, we don't put ourselves in a position of having external forces, because this is a national security issue, not just a system security issue, putting something in place that would be impossible.
I think Ms. Hudgens is next, and then Mr.
I know. I know we have to line this up, and I hope that we'll, what we'll do is try and move to a point where we can talk about what we should do. But I want to just put this in perspective. Every day, the general manager and his team decides to take a train out of service because it doesn't operate. And passengers can't move. And they understand that. And they assume a decision was made because of someone had the capacity to make that decision that understood it. I know that's not putting it in comparison to constitutional rights and privacy and the like. But I think this is talking about a trust and a relationship issue. And that's what this is about. And I think what has been said about how we as the board respond to that relationship is very important in how we measure it. I think we started off talking about what do we say and how and when do we say it to our customers. And I think we have ample opportunity and have used that from the role that establishing rider voices to give us input. But I don't want us to lose sight of what we have said is our responsibility. And that's the part that I think is the dilemma and how we should move forward from this. I'm not sure we want to have someone say they are going to inform us when they have such a high credible threat in order for them to know to make a decision. We are to exercise, I think, a level of oversight that allows the system to run all the time, safety or operationally, to the best protection of our riders and the general public. So I, as a comment to constituents that I've talked to about this, I'm okay with them being on the other side of that discussion and pushing us. That's what they should do. And if I were in a different seat, I would do that. But the role that we play at this board is a different one. And I hope that we will narrow our discussion to how do we work with our customers on this and all communication issues.
Mr. Wells?
Well, I think I start a lot where Ms. Porter started, and I do think that the board, in trying to figure out a standard, I mean, the board gets into some pretty specific issues about expenditure of dollars, like should we repair a 1000 series car. So I do think that some standard of how we review, and also to know the standard that's being used by the general manager, I think it's very important to the board as communicated to the public. And the other thing that Ms. Porter started with is an investment of dollars, and what's the smartest investment of dollars to assure safety for the passengers. And I know that there is a level of frustration of current safety and ongoing safety at the, you know, in our system, whether it be related to muggings or other things that are going on, that it's not that one terrorist threat we're putting out there looming in fear of, but there's the fear of things that are occurring today. And in terms of, and it'll be my last question on this, but in terms of investment, of dollars to keep us safe, one of the things that really makes a difference is certainty of getting caught. And I've, a couple of things have occurred that have caused me to have some question about our camera ability, of how much we actually see, and if we have a camera system that is adequate to the standards, Chief, that you need in order to create certainty of getting caught, whether, you know, there's someone being injured on a platform or elsewhere in our system. And that certainly goes to the issue of deployment of your staff, where cameras can help in that area. And so when we look at where we invest our funds, are we where we need to be in investment with our camera system?
I think we are very fortunate that the Department of Homeland Security and TSA, through their grants and the applications that we've made for cameras in our stations, and in the case of the District of Columbia, I mean, Mr. Graham made it available that at least 10 stations were equipped with cameras, but the most of the cameras that are coming in now are coming in through grants from TSA for outside of the stations or cameras on the trains and buses and on the ends of the portal. So we are very grateful for the expenditures or the grants that they've provided. Will that provide us with a better ability to catch people? It may be something that better enables us to investigate or to conclude. When you have cameras, there are a lot of cameras that are already in the system, and so you need to have smart technology, and that's what we're shooting for, so that the cameras tell us when something is out of the norm. But it won't necessarily guarantee that we will prevent every crime that takes place, but it will aid us, and so we're very grateful to them. One bit that I would like to say, here in the National Capital Region, we're very fortunate to work with the FBI, the Department of Homeland Security, and most of you that come from a political subdivision have a member that's on the Joint Terrorism Task Force, and that has proven to be very beneficial, because when we talk about specific and credible threats, some of those threats happen every hour, every day, and they're the people that follow up on those threats. And a lot of times, the planning takes on 6-7 months. So try to wait for specific threats, and you're behind the curve. So we appreciate the level of collaboration and effort with them. Many times, information is shared with me. I share it to the best of my ability with the general manager, absent the source that talks about things that it's not in the public's arena. But those are things that happen every day, and I think, as Mr. Downey indicated, transit is a very, very, very lucrative target. And I think that's quite clear in all the regions that you want to go. And right behind New York, Washington, D.C. is one that raises a lot of concerns and considerations on our part. And again, we have the obligation to make sure that we've done everything in our power to make sure that all of our customers, all of our employees, and our facilities are safeguarded. And it may not seem logical to a lot of people, but is the reality in which we live in.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I think we're going to have to pretty quickly.
I have one additional
well.
Comment, and I want to say I very much appreciate the very serious and thoughtful concerns that everybody's raised. I feel very much better that the board has been thinking about this. I would like to. There were a lot of issues though that were raised that aren't, we haven't concluded yet. What is the next step on this issue?
I was going to make a suggestion. One of the things that struck me is that without constraining any of either the CEO's or the chief's authority, the board could articulate some of the values that Ms. Hewitt said about non-profiling, non-discrimination, minimizing difficulties of access, et cetera, as the value framework, including the value that Peter just articulated so eloquently about this unresolved conflict in our democracy as a nation about individual liberty versus the needs of the whole society around this particular threat. We're no different than the entire country about struggling with this, but we could probably articulate our own values as a board, on behalf of not just the staff, but also our customers, to say that these are the frameworks that we would be accountable for about trying to give some value guidance to the professionals in this process. The other is that I don't think it's necessary to make commitments to, say, public hearings or anything about the process of change, but I'm struck by how difficult it is in this area to have a structured dialogue between the public and the security folks, not about whether or not they did the right thing or the wrong thing, but this is a partnership. We protect airline passengers, but we don't have a way for them to be part of the discussion going forward. We protect our customers, and most of the data shows that the most valuable participant in this is the willingness of customers to participate in the security process with us. To have a clear message and clear channels of communication that says it is okay for you to be upset, at least in part. It's okay for you to have concerns. It's okay for you to have suggestions about different ways of doing stuff. And have it be open, have it be accessible, and have it be part of what we take into consideration about funding and staffing or suggested conversations about modification as we go forward. There is nothing in this process right now that I can see that actively encourages and provides channels for our customers to be part of this dialogue. I know part of that we expect to come through the RAC, but part of it is we have other tools and other mechanisms for directly accessing or have our customers directly give information and feedback back to us that we're not taking advantage of, and we're not saying we're interested in that feedback. And I think we should be. That's one of the things I think the board could do without being in any way constraining of the authority of the professional staff about making the right decisions. We can establish values. We can say we want a more open process with our customers. And I don't know that that's too controversial, but it is a way of trying to do a next step that is a little different than where we've been so far. Mr. McKay?
I don't want to prolong this, but I like what you said, but I approach it with a great deal of caution. My value judgment was different on September 10th, 2001 than it was September 12th, 2001. Given the variable nature of the world that we live in, based on what I see in the news and what happened yesterday, my value judgment changes on a daily basis. And so should our security professionals. And so if we're going to write a value judgment statement that gives parameters, I start to get concerned. I start to get concerned that I don't know that I want to be held accountable for the way I feel about security today as I do tomorrow if something happens later today. And so I think we can, with generalization, give our idea. But I got to tell you, having served on this board now over 3 years, I don't know many things we've gotten more input on than this. From the RAC, from MetroRiders.org, who, by the way, haven't been mentioned but have a very different evaluation of what's going on. From individual customers who have contacted my office, from newspaper articles that have been written and commented on. There are a few things we've gotten more commentary on than this. And so I don't think for a minute we have an invited commentary from the public. We've taken it. We got it at our last board meeting. I hope we continue to get it. That's part of running the system, is to hear from our customers. But coming up with a value statement and parameters under which our chief and general manager operate in a subject like this, I think presents itself with a lot of challenges to the day-to-day real-world operation that they live in. And so if we're going to go down that path, I think we have to do it with a great deal of caution, and I think we have to do with a great deal of vagueness as to what we're asking for, because today's environment's different than tomorrow's, And as long as we're approaching it with that mindset, I'm okay with doing that, but it is a huge caution on my part to start to go down that path.
I think that we've done this one. But I'm glad we have. It's a discussion we'll probably have again and again over time, but it's the right discussion to be having. So, thank you. And that, unless there's anything else that anyone wants to add to the agenda for this committee is adjourned.
Well, what time are we going to